The Guardian.
Before you get started with this edition of the Books podcast, we want to point you in the direction of our sponsor, Squarespace. For everything you need to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian to get 10% off your first purchase. And now, on with the show.
The writing life can sometimes be a lonely one, the author stranded on the desert of the empty page. But publication has never been a solitary occupation. In the world before Amazon, the writer could rely on a friend, champion, and critical eye in the form of an editor. But as the digital age puts the squeeze on traditional publishing, critics complain that editors are under threat, clogging our literary culture with cliché, bloat, and lazy repetition. Are they simply looking back with rose-tinted glasses, or is the art of editing in decline? And if there's no time for editing in modern publishing, how does that change the books we read? What does an editor actually do? For Diana Attill, who published writers such as Jean Rhys and V.S. Naipaul, an editor's job is perfectly straightforward.
And really, what the editor must remember to do is read, and read with great attention. Make it sound like you know the author wanted it to sound. That's all. That's all. Because no book, once it's out, ever gets read with proper attention. It's very interesting, this. You can get a wonderful review from somebody who seems to have enjoyed your book enormously. Halfway through it, he says something which shows that he simply didn't understand one, you know, a sentence. He gets it completely wrong. Your editor is the person you must trust, that they have read it with complete attention. And if you're a good editor, you're really trying to make it sound like you know the author wanted it to sound. You're wanting it to be as much like the author's book as it possibly can be.
Talk to an editor like Matt Weiland, vice president and senior editor at W.W. Norton, and the part of the job he puts first and foremost is finding the right authors.
Well, part of it, I feel, is, recognizing not just a writer of talent, but what may be the best book for her to write. You know, oftentimes writers aren't yet sure, especially writers who are at an early stage of their career. I love working with debut authors, and one of the challenges there is that, good writers are curious people, and they have lots of good ideas, and it may be that it isn't their first or their second or even their fifth idea that's the right one to be that writer's first book. And so I spend a lot of my time talking with writers and their agents about what should be their first book, what should they focus on, and I don't pretend to know, I just, the answer. I just have an instinct sometimes that, one good idea may make for a great magazine piece or a series in the newspaper or, as is increasingly the case, a part of, a podcast. But that may not be the best book or the most lasting book or indeed the most sellable book. And so I think part of my task, I feel like on behalf of the writers that I want to publish, and of course in the interests of the publishing house where I work, is to help rustle up good books. And that's one of the great pleasures of it. I always feel like the bounds between, one's professional life and personal life, or the things you're interested in personally, they just bleed together. And that can be exhausting, of course, but it's also, that's one of the great joys. Anyone you meet who has a good idea or can write or has written something of interest is potentially someone that you may want to publish.
After identifying your author and helping them work out what the best book for them to write might be, the editor is confronted with a first draft, Weiland continues, at which point the challenge is often to work out what shouldn't be there.
Writers feel great pressure to produce, a perfect book on first draft, and especially for writers starting out, that's exceedingly rare. I have two guiding mantras in my editing. I'm going to mangle both of these quotes, by the way. But one of them is Hazlitt, whose great idea was ease and force. Writing should be, at least in English, should be conversational, should be concise and clear. The other is from Miles Davis, who when he was asked how he composed those incredibly beautiful spare compositions of the late 50s, I can't do Miles Davis' voice, but he said he always listened for what he could best leave out. And I think that's a really important thing for writers to keep in mind, that often by taking away and leaving things out, a piece of writing can be made stronger.
But as the digital revolution tears up the traditional settlement between reader, writer, and publisher, editors are finding it increasingly difficult to find the time for such concentrated work. Ask Francesca Main, editorial director at Picador, and she'll tell you that publishers in the 21st century need to do much more than get out the blue pen. So what does an editor actually do all day?
Well, not a lot of editing, which is not to say that editors don't edit, because they do. But the modern editor's job involves a huge variety of things. I mean, whenever I go and sort of give talks about what it is to be an editor at creative writing courses and such like, I try and sort of break it down and say that the modern editor is part commissioner, part editor, and part project manager. And I think that's how it breaks down, really. I think your responsibilities are to acquire new talent or find new books for the list, to edit the books that you have, to work with the writers, but actually it's the project management side that seems to take up the vast majority of the working day, whether that's maintaining relationships with authors and agents, keeping everyone involved, making sure your colleagues have information, writing jacket briefs. I mean, I could sort of reel off sort of 10 things that I've done today, which is...
Go on then, 10 things.
10? Oh God, now I have to count. Okay. So today I have... attended an editorial meeting, which was the Picador editorial team and various colleagues from all the different departments in-house. So a mixture of bringing new books forward as potential acquisitions, to talking about the latest events we've been working on, to talking about which covers we're going to brief next week and that kind of thing. So I've attended that meeting in which I told everybody about a debut novel that I've just read and would really like us to publish. So we've had a discussion about that. I've sent quite a lot of emails. I read 60 pages of a submission over lunch at my desk. So no 4-hour lunches finished off with brandy here. I really like what I've read. I've emailed the agent about it because she already has a publisher who wants to offer on it. I've emailed one of my writers about her paperback date. I've started typing up editorial notes on a first draft that I've just read, and I'm meeting the author tomorrow. I have sent a cover idea to someone in our art department who's been struggling to find the right image for one of our books. I could go on.
What about getting out the red pencil?
Well, it's blue pen for me.
Always blue.
That's my preference, yes. Yeah, well, because it shows up on the page, but it seems less intrusive.
Less shouty.
Exactly.
So when do you get a chance to do all that then?
Well, sometimes I'll often try and have no meetings on a Friday and either work from home editing something all day, or we have various rooms like the one we're in now, where ideally there are no meetings booked, although with open plan working, sometimes that goes awry, to sit quietly. Because it is quite hard, even on a quiet day in an open plan office, it is quite hard to have the sort of concentration and headspace, either without getting distracted by what's going on around you or by distracting yourself, because the internet is right there and you're getting emails every minute and then the phone rings and then you're called away by someone to go and look at something or whatever it might be. So I think quiet space is necessary, and inevitably some of it takes place in evenings after work or on weekends, and that's just the sort of hidden, sort of unspoken understanding of the whole thing, I think.
As the demands of project management push the time-consuming business of making sure all the right words are in the right order into evenings and weekends, Diana Attill says agents are stepping into the breach.
The publishers are getting lazy and saving money. But, I mean, not always. My publisher has good editors. But some of them obviously don't. I mean, some of them you really can see are very sloppy.
Do you think they're sloppier now than they used to be?
Oh, yes, I think they are. I mean, I think if one is worried by such things, it doesn't worry me very much. But some people get quite sort of scarlet in the face with fury about the things that go, they notice in books that are not, haven't been picked up.
For the critic Alex Clark, the sloppiness Attil detects is a matter of time.
Well, I mean, there it's one of those kind of, you know, death of the novel type things. It's frequently said, I'm sure I've said it myself, that editing is in a state of a certain kind of decline. And I think, in a sense, that's true, although I wouldn't want to make too bold a claim for it, because there is clearly brilliant editing going on, and there are clearly brilliant editors and wonderful books coming out.
Yeah, those editors are always in whoever one is talking to in their particular patch. My editor, brilliant, of course, and my company, my publisher, marvellous. But over
really,
there,
yeah, I don't really want to think. I don't really think authors want to say my editor terrible. Not in these kind of precarious times. But I think what is probably difficult to get past is the reality that the massive conglomeration of publishers has led to a greater amount of money, time, resource going on a fewer number of books, a fewer number of big books, and that the time that an editor has to lavish on the pages and the manuscript of an individual author, perhaps a bit lower down the sort of corporate ecology,
whether that be in terms of profile or sales or whatever, but just anything that has less interest in it, there's just less time to deal with. Do you think it's a question of time?
I think that broadly speaking, editors have less time to sit in their offices, going through a manuscript page by page, line by line, pen in hand, and then building in the necessary stages with a writer to work through that. And again, I think that some people prioritise that. I think it depends on the kind of book. I think it depends on where you think it's going to sit in the list. A time pressure, getting it into these very fraught publishing schedules. You know, all these factors come into play.
Editors may be under increasing pressure in the UK and the US, but according to Stefan Tobler, the founder of translation specialist Imprint and Other Stories, there's little appetite for thorough editing elsewhere.
I would actually say in a lot of the world, the editing culture is probably less healthy and probably has been less healthy for a long time than it is in the Anglophone world. We do a lot of translations, and also as a translator, you know, I've picked up books from other countries to translate, and in both cases, it's quite often the case that there are really large structural things that were not worked out before it was the book was published in the foreign country. Not always, but it happens. And you know, repetitions that were unnecessary and phrasing that just doesn't quite ring true. And it's an interesting challenge then, as when you're publishing a translation, as to how much you would change something that's already been published. So yeah, I definitely have the feeling that in some parts of the world, the editing culture is not as deeply rooted as here. And that might be also because the idea of collaborating between author and editor is something which is not as accepted. I remember one Spanish editor saying that if they suggested changes to a book to an author, that the author would be offended, in a way that I think most authors here are willing to work on the book to get it polished.
For the literary agent Carolina Sutton, whose clients include Emma Healy, Anne Patchett and Naomi Klein, the pressures on editors are changing the role entirely.
There are certainly fewer resources in publishing for focused editing. I think, you know, editors have to do so much more than just edit. They have to be champions for the book, they have to position the book, they have to work closely with marketing and sales teams. A lot of the work these days is about positioning, which is a very, very different skill. I mean, you have editors who can quietly transform a book from being a complete mess to being a work of genius. But those editors aren't always the best commissioning editors, and they're not always the best, they don't always have the most astute commercial sense.
So, what is positioning exactly?
Increasingly, publishing is about positioning. I think in a decade ago, publishing was about controlling access. It was about gatekeeping. It was about filtering and sifting the good from the bad, and it was about printing and distribution. It was about the control of the means of printing, publishing, and distribution. Right now, you can publish a book tomorrow yourself. You can make it available, and you can make it available to millions of people around the world without a publisher's input or involvement. And it's become something different. I think publishing now is more than anything else, it's about finding an audience. It's about taking a book or a manuscript and determining what it is, where it sits, what category it is, who the readers may be, and finding those readers. And successful publishers and successful editors these days not only edit, but then they have to identify and find that audience and take the book to that audience. We call it, it's a very ugly word, it's discoverability. I can't even say it. but it's how do you, in that huge jungle out there, you know, of books and self-published books and all sorts of self-publishing platforms and free online content, how do you make a book or a piece of writing stand out? And now that is the publisher's job.
But publishing has always been about finding an audience, insists Matt Weiland.
You know, I mean, the point about publishers is that they make public, and that involves a lot of jumping up and down and waving arms and honking. And that, as an editor, that's a big part of my job, and I love that part. Sure, that's a pressure, and I think the amount of time an editor needs to spend doing that kind of cheerleading work, which I relish, has certainly increased. But, you know, like any job, there's a lot to do, and you somehow manage to fit it all in. I think the bigger pressure on the time an editor has to go back and forth with a writer is at some publishers, happily not my own, there can be a feeling of, you know, just put it through. It's good enough.
Despite the pressures on publishers in the age of the internet, Francesca Main rejects the notion that the art of editing is in some sort of decline.
Well, I personally would dispute it, but I'm also aware that I can only really speak for myself and the editors that I know. I mean, certainly within the editors that I know, whether they're my colleagues or my peers or my friends, there is an awful lot of editing and wonderful unsung editing. So I would say that there is an awful lot of editing going on, but I'm also very aware that I can't speak for every single editor in the business.
Mm. I mean, what about your experience as a reader? I mean, do you find the books that you're reading that are being produced elsewhere are falling off in quality to compare to 5-10 years ago?
Not necessarily, but I would say because I'm a selective reader and because, as I'm sure you'll understand, as much as I try and read as much as possible that is being published now and that, you know, still my favourite thing to do in my spare time is read, because the spare time that I have when I'm not asleep or trying not to become a hermit is taken up with reading submissions, reading new drafts by my authors, editing books, I am aware that even with the best will in the world, I can only manage to read a certain fraction of books being published here and now. And that does make me very selective as a reader. And it does mean that if I get 5 chapters into something I don't think is much good, I will stop and find something else.
I mean, is that partly, I mean, one of the experiences of it, when you ask people about this, is that if you ask people who are as outside the business as such, they'll say, oh, yes, it's, you know, things are, you know, turning from bad to worse, it's terrible, you know, the decline of modern literary culture. But nevertheless, when you talk to people working in the business, they say, well, it's fine here, we're doing fine. Is it partly because your focus has to be so closely on the things that you're involved with?
I think it's sort of true that throughout every decade, there is a certain amount of outcry that things used to be much better in a golden age and that things now are terrible. And falling apart. And I mean, I have this really great book at home. I think it's called Editors on Editing. I'd have to look it up for you. It's a sort of compilation of pieces and essays by editors. And one of them was, I think, published first in 1962 and written by M. Lincoln Schuster, who was one of the founders of Simon & Schuster. And he is writing about the sort of pressures of the modern editor and the ways in which you have to be able to pitch a book in one sentence and the sort of pressures that you're on beyond the time at your desk that you get to edit. And it just made me think so much of that, like, could have been written nowadays, but, you know, the tone, the language is slightly different and some of the examples are different, but so many things are exactly the same. And it is just a reminder that we're always decrying that standards are slipping, and actually I don't know that there is a huge amount of difference, really.
Maybe even the Golden Age wasn't all that golden. Maxwell Perkins, who worked with Ernest Hemingway and F. Scott Fitzgerald, may have been hailed by his biographer as an editor of genius, but Diana Attill has grave doubts about his efforts to grapple with the novels of Thomas Wolfe.
I think there's a good deal of nonsense talked about the Golden Age, actually. And some of the sort of things, the great editing that was held up, what was he, or Maxwell Perkins, who took that poor nut and made worked with him with utmost devotion, nearly killing himself doing it for years to get him publishable. And he's unreadable. And he always was unreadable.
And what do you make of someone like Gordon Lish, who famously, I mean, he cuts large quantities of Raymond Carver's short stories and presented them as this brand new thing?
That was an interesting and worrying thing, very worrying, because, I mean, Raymond Carver, to me, was a model writer, how good he was. And when I learnt that, in fact, it was his editor's work, I was rather cross about that. He produced a lot of very readable and lovely stuff, but it was not right.
For the writer and critic DJ Taylor, concerns about a decline in the art of editing seldom take into account the wider perspective.
What we must remember, I think, certainly looking at in the context of British publishing, is that the editor is a fairly late arrival in British publishing. Alec Waugh, Evelyn Waugh's elder brother, who worked for some years at his father's firm, Arthur Waugh, their dad was a publisher, Chapman and Hall in the 1920s, remarked on the fact that the editorial function barely existed in those days. And if you'd asked Arnold Bennett, who was, you know, a best-selling Chapman and Hall author of the day, if you had asked him who his editor was at Henrietta Street, the firm's premises, he wouldn't have known what you were talking about, because publishers assumed that writers knew their business 100 years ago. And so you produced a typescript. It was obviously read by your publisher, and then it was printed. And the only thing that publishers got anxious about and really had close readings for was the prospect of obscenity. Because this was a time when, you know, books could be prosecuted by Home Secretaries. Anthony Pohl, who worked at Duckworth, again, he was probably called an editor just about in the late 1920s and early 30s. And Pohl remembered an occasion where a female member of the staff whose father was a bookseller in the Midlands said that her father had refused to stock a book that contained the word bottom. And that was the kind of thing that publishers were having to deal with. And so a publisher would read a book very carefully to see whether it sailed close to the wind. But in terms of how it, you know, unless it was completely incoherent, it was assumed that a writer knew his business. And you would assume that it had reached you in a state in which it was publishable. Yes.
Look back beyond the 20th century, back to the world of Herman Melville, Anthony Trollope, the Brontes and Jane Austen, says Professor of Bibliography and Textual Criticism Catherine Sutherland, and the back and forth between author and editor fades away.
Publishers' editors really didn't exist at that time. Essentially, the publisher's editor is a product of the 20th century and of technological changes that are coming in from the late 19th century, specifically changes that mean that the printing house is not requiring the high level of professional skills that previously it had.
Yeah, so the technology steps in to the messy business of organising the type on the page.
Technology is stepping in throughout the 19th century, but certainly by the end of the 19th century, some of the high-level skills that a typesetter really needed up to about 1850, so from Caxton's time, so from 1450 up to about 1850, those skills were no longer required.
And so before that time, we don't really see publishers getting involved with authors in shaping the text?
Not in a general way, no. There are obviously specific instances where there are partnerships, friendships, close relationships over perhaps a career between an author and a bookseller, publisher. But the actual work of a copy editor, no.
Was there anybody doing anything resembling a contemporary editor's job in this kind of stage?
I think the person we would turn to for that is William Gifford. He was the editor of Murray's journal, the Quarterly Review. And Murray himself was the most fashionable publisher in London. And he was also known, unusually at the time, for producing very high quality products. So it was known that his books looked good. And William Gifford, the editor of his journal, seems also to have acted as Murray's informal talent scout and as a kind of copy editor for Murray. not quite a Maxwell Perkins that we come to in the 20th century, but something close to that in some way. And so it is Gifford who suggests that Murray take a punt on Jane Austen. Gifford's been reading around. Murray doesn't publish novels, but Gifford said, this is an interesting novelist. She's worth, you know, taking a risk on. And he writes to Murray and he says, and I'll ready her novels for the press. I will correct her manuscript. There are infelicities of punctuation. I'll correct those.
But it's the punctuation that he really minds about.
It's the punctuation that he is concerned about, because he says, really, these novels are very good. They're very well written. There's nothing much else to worry about.
Yeah, but Gifford is very much, he's a trailblazer. He's developing a new role.
Well, it's interesting. It is certainly an unusual role. Whether he is developing it or whether he's just a kind of unusual moment in the history of what's going on in the 19th century is harder to determine, because so much of the evidence really is just a matter of case studies, individual relations between, say, an author and a publisher, or a publisher's, copy editor. But those roles of copy editor and relationships between copy editors and authors are not really established until the 20th century.
So what kind of attention would a writer expect from a publisher? I mean, you say bookseller, publisher, are they much the same thing?
They're dividing off from each other. In the really old days, a printing press might be situated in a part of a house with a bookseller in another part of the house, and the bookseller would be, as it were, the front of house person.
If we're looking at the beginning of the 19th century, and perhaps back into the 18th century, what kind of attention would an author expect from the person who is going to publish their book?
Well, one of the things that might surprise us today when we think of how we produce things in really neat typescripts, one of the things is, of course, that the author might hand in an extremely messy handwritten manuscript.
With crossings out,
with arrows pointing to extra loose leaves, with all kinds of mess. And it would be the job of the printing house to sort that out. To get everything in the right order, even down to perhaps paragraphing for the author, certainly correcting punctuation, correcting spelling. There were printer's manuals that start very early on in the history of printing. And by the 18th, early 19th century, these manuals are well established. Manuals like Caleb Stower's Printer's Manual of 1808. And printing houses would largely follow the rules laid down in those. Authors would not follow those rules, nor would booksellers, but the printing house would. And they would establish the printed text from messy manuscript according to these rules.
And so then the author would be sent, a bunch of proofs, would they?
The author would be sent proofs, yes.
And this would be a question of just checking that the spelling was correct and that...
Checking that the whole thing looked as they wished it to look. An author would expect a significant transformation from manuscript to print. The other thing that's worth mentioning is that printing houses wouldn't rarely tie up a whole body of type by producing, say, a complete novel in one typesetting from a whole range of type. What they would do is they would set up, say, 24 pages of a novel in type. They would send the proof of that over to the author for checking. The author would check it, send it back. The type would be broken up after corrections were made, and then another 24 pages might be set. So an author wouldn't see a continuous proof of their work from one end to the other, which is why in some instances authors express real surprise when they see their manuscript turned into print. Some things they think wouldn't have looked quite the way they do because they've not had a chance to look at the whole thing.
Yeah, so I mean, but we don't get correspondence about, we should maybe have a little more of this character here, or we should, are you sure you want to end it in such a terrible way?
We don't necessarily get correspondence of that dramatic kind. We certainly get correspondence, say, from Jane Austen writing to her sister, where she says, I've just opened Pride and Prejudice and I realise that, a couple of paragraphs have been set as one and I thought they were two speeches and the printer's misunderstood. She notes with some amusement changes to her spelling. Spelling at this stage wasn't stabilised. But printing houses might have a preferred spelling. And she spelt a word. In fact, it was the word arrowroot, which we rarely use nowadays. And
except the biscuit, perhaps.
Well, yes, except the biscuit, of course. And she spelt it as she pronounced it. And she had quite a strong Hampshire accent. And so she spelt it arrowroot. and the printer has connected this. And she's amused by that.
But she's not discussing things about the characters or...
No, she doesn't seem to be doing that.
But just because Jane Austen could produce novels of genius without anything we would recognise as editorial input, that doesn't mean contemporary publishers should deny their authors the advantages of collaboration, says Alex Clark.
Well, Austen was a genius. I mean, I think, you know, we always have this problem with snapshots, don't we? You know, posterity has preserved a certain number of writers for us, and when we look further, there are even more beyond the immediately observable canon. But there's also a lot of dross. In any age, in any culture, there's an awful lot of stuff that, well, you know, actually some of it may be good, not dross at all, but it somehow didn't capture the imagination, and a lot of it is actually just bad. And so I think, you know, Austen, we say, is an exception.
What about those who say the decline that is generally assumed is merely the function of people looking back with rose-tinted glasses?
Well, there's probably something of that, and I kind of feel, you know, as I walk out of here today, I shall simply be struck off a list of any publishing party I went ever. You know, I will never drink a martini in this town again, with furious editors who are sort of absolutely throwing themselves into their work, and I know they do. And I think rather than it being a question of individuals, I think it's a question of a general shift in the literary culture. That's what I think is an issue. Now, we all have to decide whether we think that matters or not.
Perhaps the whole concept of editing, that slow business of quietly making something better, is simply out of tune with the 21st century constitutionally opposed to judgments of quality. There are editors who are improving manuscripts immensely, even at the more commercial end of the market, Carolina Sutton argues, but sometimes their work is simply less valued.
I was talking today to a literary scout, and she brought up an example of piracy in Russia, where big bestsellers are not only pirated but translated by amateur translators before publication and made available online, and they are hugely popular. And people don't care about the quality of the translation. Rather than waiting for the official version, they are more than happy to read the next installment of the big blockbuster before it's published. And that is quite. I guess that is quite depressing, but perhaps perhaps this is something to do with the general cultural shift from writing and the quality of the writing to a story-driven and plot-driven literary culture.
For DJ Taylor, the ambition to straightforwardly improve a manuscript is under threat from more than 21st century suspicions of value judgment.
Yes, I suppose there are, you know, fashionable egalitarian notions and also the notions of self-expression. You know, I've said this, these are my thoughts, you must print them. I think that you do sometimes, there is sometimes sort of that. And I think the idea that, I think some writers would probably resent the imputation that what they had vouchsafed to their publishers was not absolutely 100% brilliant. But a lot of stuff isn't. You know, some very great writers have needed the attention of editors.
But even in a culture increasingly focused on plot rather than quality, in a century where judgments of literary worth are hedged with qualifications, Matt Weiland insists there's nothing objectionable about the notion of editing.
You know, an editor is just a reader, really, and a particularly engaged one and one with an interest, surely. But I don't see how anybody can be against that, you know. I think with all, you know, due respect to small d democratic ideals, you know, I rather like the idea that as a writer that someone I value and trust and ideally like is going to have a first crack at, you know, reading what I've written and telling me what they make of it. And, you know, that's to me, that's a very democratic ideal in its own right. As an editor, I feel like the most valuable thing I can tell a reader on a manuscript is, I don't understand this, or I'm bored here, you know? I hope of real value. I hope to write those things. I write those things very often in margins. I hope to write them less in each succeeding draft. And certainly, I only do so in the interest of other readers. I always feel better if I genuinely feel that way about a line or a paragraph or a portion of a manuscript. It's better the writer hear it from me than they, you know, hear it from a critic in the pages of The Guardian when the book is reviewed.
If the ever-increasing demands of cheerleading and project management mean that the modern editor has less time to focus on the kind of engaged reading Weiland describes, then what do we as readers, what does literary culture stand to lose? Carolina Sutton is clear about what's at stake.
Well, culture. It's as simple as that. That's why I think it's really important. I think publishers have a huge cultural and moral responsibility to have these, and I think most publishers have that. I think most great publishers have imprints who run according to slightly different rules, long term, and they are not subject to the same market pressures. And really what great publishing houses do is they protect that part of the market. So they allow editors to work on manuscripts and they give them more time. It's perhaps less commercially, it's less competitive. You can develop writers over a longer period, even though the rewards, financial rewards, are not immediate. Having said that, that was probably easier to protect that section of the market a few years ago than it is now.
Tara Tobler, a writer and editor who's the other half of the husband and wife team at Another Stories, is a little more sanguine.
I think that the people who care passionately still care and care very deeply, and they will find each other out the way they found each other out for the last 500 years of publishing books. I think that real literary culture has always been a bit of a niche, and it persists that way, even if the rest of the world is changing much more quickly than it is.
But Alex Clark refuses to give up on an aspiration for excellence across the broad sweep of literary culture.
Well, we stand to lose work that has been really carefully made as good as it can be. And I go back to that idea that a writer has to recognise their own vision. They need to see through all the potential of a work. A work has to cohere inside itself. I was, funnily enough, talking about this in terms of somebody who first commissioned me as a reviewer many, many years ago, and who once said to me, you must review the book that is in front of you, not the book that you wanted the author to write. And it is the single best piece of advice that I've ever been given. And an editor in the same way has a vision for a book, but it is subordinate to the writer's vision, and it will always have to work with what that writer can do. But goodness, I've heard writers be so thankful for the work that their editor has done on a book. And I think we lose that piece of collaboration. We know that writing is solitary far more than it is collaborative, but that doesn't mean it's wholly uncollaborative.
It doesn't mean that we need to settle for anything less than the very best.
I don't think we should. Why would we?
You can find more literary discussion on iTunes, SoundCloud, or on the Guardian website. Just search for Guardian Books Podcast. Next week, we'll be examining the eternal appeal of the Brontes with Tracy Chevalier, Esther Freud, and Sally Vickers. Until then, thanks from me, Richard Lee, and our producer, Rowan Slaney. See you next week.
This Guardian podcast is sponsored by Squarespace. To find out more about how to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.